Recently, I watched a series entitled The Great Debate on Science and the Bible on the John Ankerberg Show. How many of you are familiar with the John Ankerberg Show? Most of you probably are. John Ankerberg, of course, is an evangelical apologist. He has on his program and has had for many years people who take issue with the so-called orthodox position, which for him is the evangelical position. That would include Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, of course, atheists, and many others. And those of you who have watched his program have seen him debate and having others on there who would debate these various groups and individuals. Well, this particular series, The Great Debate on Science and the Bible, featured a debate between young earth creationists and old earth creationists. Now, the young earth creationists were Ken Ham and astrophysicist Dr. Jason Lyle. Some of you may be familiar with Ken Ham. How many of you know about his ministry? It's called Answers in Genesis, and it's his headquarters office is in Kentucky. You may have heard of the Creation Museum up there. It's about 12 miles from the Cincinnati Airport. Some of you may have visited it. It's very impressive. I haven't been there myself. I've seen pictures of it, know people who have been there. And apparently it's very impressive. All the dinosaurs and things he has there. Of course, he believes that dinosaurs, including Tyrannosaurus Rex and all the others, existed at the same time Adam and Eve existed. So he's one of the foremost apologists for the young earth creationist view. His colleague there, the person who was arguing with him, was Jason Lyle. He was an astrophysicist. And on the other side, on the old earth, we had Dr. Walter Kaiser and astrophysicist Dr. Hugh Ross. You may have heard of him. His ministry is called Reasons to Believe. And he believes in what is called the day-age theory of creation. He believes the earth is billions of years old, not merely 6,000, as Ken Ham believes. You know, Ken Ham believes that the whole universe leapt into existence about 6,000 years ago, whereas Hugh Ross says, no, it was billions of years ago when God created. And, of course, there's a difference in how they interpret the days of creation. Young Earth creationism says, as I said, the Earth, and indeed the entire universe, is only 6,000 years old. And each of the days, those 6 days described in Genesis 1, are literal 24-hour days. They believe, of course, that the Earth was made, and when they say the Earth, they mean the planet Earth, was made on day one, the same day that God made light. We'll see later, interestingly enough, God didn't make the sun until the fourth day. I wonder about that. You mean he had light but not the sun? But anyway, that's what young earth theorists actually argue. The day-age theory, and people who uphold that position or believe in that position, say that the universe is billions of years old and that each day, in the Hebrew, the word is yom, each yom, the first yom, the second yom, all the way to the sixth yom, represents or is not just a 24-hour day, but a very long age, maybe several thousand years or in some cases several million years. So Dr. Hugh Ross is one of the foremost proponents of the day-age theory, and that's the way he explains it. The morning and the evening for him, that just represents the opening and closing of one age, you know, the closing of one age, evening, morning, the opening of a new age. And so he interprets it that way. And Dr. Walter Kaiser, who was also in the camp of the old earthers, Kaiser has a very interesting theory which allows for a very old earth, but since he says, I'm not a scientist, I'm a theologian, he leaves how old to the scientists. And his theory goes like this. He points out that the word yom has different meanings not only in the Bible but in the creation account itself. In Genesis 1, well, just look at it here. Genesis 1, we won't look at this the whole chapter of Genesis 1, but you'll notice it says in verse 14, we'll go ahead and read that. Genesis 1, verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God made them or set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. So you mean he created the sun, the moon, and the stars on the fourth day. Is that what we're reading here? Of course, I think most of us know that there's a different way of explaining this. But in any case, both Kaiser and the young earth creationists take this to mean that, yes, indeed, he made the sun on the fourth day. That the light that he made on the first day didn't come from the sun. It came from someplace else. And an all-powerful being can do that. And that's the argument. And so his argument is this. You look at this, the fourth day, that is the first day that is determined by the sun and its relationship to the earth. So it's the first, what we would call, 24-hour day. We don't know how long the three preceding days, or yams, were. That's his argument. It kind of makes sense. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it kind of makes sense. And he adds to that the fact that if you look at the seventh day, that it doesn't have a closure. It doesn't say anything about the evening and the morning or the seventh day. And if you go to Hebrews 4, you see that indeed the seventh day, the writer of Hebrews says, God finished his works from the foundation of the world. And then we read that he then entered his rest. And the point is, we're invited now to enter his rest. So he's still in his rest. So the seventh day is open-ended. That's Kaiser's argument. And so it obviously doesn't represent a mere 24-hour day, even though he acknowledges there was a Sabbath throughout the Old Testament. But in any case, that's the argument he makes. So he says we don't really know how long the first 3 days were. And since the seventh day is open-ended and is still going on in some sense. Okay, so those are the basic arguments. And I'll tell you, I'm not going to resolve the debate today. That's not my point. I'm not going to give you all the answers. One thing, for one reason, I don't know all the answers. And the second reason, it would take so long to go through all the material, and at the end of it would realize that you have a whole lot of arguments and a whole lot of questions. You might have some answers, but you'd have a lot of questions. So I could create more questions than I could answers. But I will talk about this a little bit today, and I'm going to take it in a little different direction. You'll see where I'm going in a little while. But as I said, I'm not going to resolve the debate. Not only do we have the views I've presented here, but there are the various gap theories. There's more than one of them. The gap theory, the one we're familiar with, that appears in our literature, that most of us have held that it's probably the best theory. And then there are modified gap theories and numerous other theories about the creation week. Well, I'm going to offer some observations about the nature of the creation narrative, and then I'm going to move on to something that is often missed, I think, by many interpreters. First, how many of you have ever witnessed a sunrise? Anybody? Do you get up that early? How many of you have ever witnessed a sunrise? What about a sunset? Yeah, you're all up that late. Yeah. Well, you're aware that the sun rises in the east. You never have seen it rise in the west, have you? Rises in the east, it climbs into the sky, and then shortly after midday, it begins to descend toward the western horizon. You're all aware of that, aren't you? Or did you never notice that? I think you are aware of it. And have you ever noticed that it follows a particular path? And that path changes a little bit throughout the year. Have you ever noticed that? That's common knowledge. We all know that. Also, I'm sure that you have observed the moon in its various phases. You've seen the thin crescent, haven't you? You know what that looks like. And you've seen it begin to build throughout the course of the month until it's finally full. It builds all the way to what we call a full moon. And then it begins to diminish again, and it's back to the crescent, and then it may disappear. You've all seen that, right? Well, everything I just said about the sun and the moon is true. But scientifically speaking, none of it is true. Not a bit of it. The sun does not rise in the east. It does not make its way across the sky. It does not go up and then descend. It does not set at the sun, at what we call sunset. It doesn't really set. What we have is, of course, a revolving, an earth turning on a planet, turning on its axis. We say it is an axis. I guess that's it's not really a pole running through it, but you know what I mean. A rotating earth. And the rotating earth is revolving around the sun. So we see all these changes due to those facts, the rotating earth, day and night, the revolution, the seasons of the year. The tilt also has something to do with it. The moon has something to do with the tilt. And, of course, you do not see a partial moon. You see a piece of the moon. You don't see, it doesn't diminish, it doesn't build. What you see is reflection of light. And we could go on to talk about the blue sky. And what I could say about the sky, thinking back from childhood when I would look up at it and see all that blue up there and see the... Sometimes I would notice during the day, toward the end of the day, it would still be blue, but stars would start to come out. They don't really come out. You know, they're already there, but that's the way I saw it, and that's the way people would describe it. Look, the stars are coming out. And the moon's already come out. Sometimes you could see the moon up there and the blue sky, and it looked like the blue sky was above the moon, didn't it? You ever notice that? And you might even talk in that terminology. You've got the moon up there, and above it and around it, the blue sky. And the blue sky really looks like a big dome, doesn't it? A big dome extending from horizon to horizon, all the way around. Under the dome, you have the sun, you have the moon. The stars come out, you begin to see them while the dome is still blue. Then it changes colors. It gets dark. It's too dark to see the pretty blue. And that's what you have. Now, of course, you know, we're not talking science. What I'm saying is true. That's the way it appears to us. It's absolutely true. But that's not scientific. We know that if you go out into space, if you're on the shuttlecraft and you want to look away from the Earth and see all that pretty blue sky out there, it's not there, is it? There's no blue sky. If the only thing you see blue from space is back on the planet, it's blue because of all the water. And, of course, well, I'm not going to explain to you how this works, but you can Google, why is the sky blue, and you can get the answers. You can find out why the sky appears blue. You can learn about light and the various wavelengths of light and how they mix to form white light, can be separated by the particles in the atmosphere and scattered. And that's why you see blue. Anyway, do a Google search on that rather than let me do it here. So we can see how we can speak of our world and all that we see, and that we speak the truth, don't we? But not with scientific precision. Now, my question is this. Can we permit the writer of the book of Genesis and the writers of the Bible to do the same thing? You know, there's been so much debate over some statements in the Bible, like the Bible does talk about the sun rising, the sun traveling its path in the heaven, and setting in the evening, descending, you know, and so on. You have all that stuff in the Bible, all that language, and there are some people who use that to show that the Bible is not to be trusted because that's scientifically inaccurate. And yet the same people will enjoy a beautiful sunrise and talk about it, and a sunset. So but my question is, can we give the writer of Genesis, as well as the other writers of Scripture, the same privilege of speaking in ordinary terms? I think we can. I think we can. And I think we can also assume safely that the writer of the creation narrative used his own terms. I do believe God inspired him, but I think he used his own terms, the terms and the expressions he was familiar with, and that those terms and expressions might even reflect an ancient cosmology which scientifically is inaccurate, and yet it still contains the truths he's trying to get across. Will you give him that? No? Yes? Okay. Good. You're on the same page. I'm glad you will, because I was about to. So I'm glad you're with me. And I think we can say also that when the writer spoke of the heavens and the earth, really the land and the sky, he didn't have in mind galaxies or quasars, or black holes, or gamma bursts, or any of those things that we read about and we see on television or hear in classroom discussions. I don't think he had any of those things in mind. In fact, I don't even think he had a spherical earth in mind. In fact, when he spoke of the earth, I don't even think he was talking about a planet necessarily. From his perspective, the only earth he knew was the land he was familiar with. Now, it may ultimately pertain, what he was saying may ultimately pertain to the whole earth. I believe God created all things. And as it turns out, it's a lot more than the way the Genesis author saw it. But nevertheless, from his perspective, and even looking at the language he used, it's much more limited than what we know. You see, we tend to read, sometimes we read anachronistically. We read a word like Earth and we think about a rotating spheroid. You know, the planet Earth. He probably didn't have that in mind at all. He's just thinking about the land that people live on, wherever that land may be. In fact, we'll see that defined in the Genesis narrative itself in just a few moments. But he was speaking, I think it's safe to say, phenomenologically. What does that mean? It means from his perspective. In other words, you're to understand the Genesis narrative, the creation narrative, from the point of view of an ancient, as if he were standing on a parcel of land describing what was going on in and above his world. I think that's the way we have to approach it. And of course, you have to give the same thing to other biblical writers who talk about the sun rising and moving across the sky and setting in the evening. The same language we use. Now, let's look at some of the, at the part of this narrative and note some of the interesting points. First, in verse 6, Genesis 1, verse 6, then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament. Now, some translations say dome, and some say expanse. God created an expanse. Now, notice what this expanse or this dome or this firmament does. He says, in the midst of the waters, and let it divide waters from waters. Now, we can put an interpretation to that, and we might even dig up some science and apply it to it. But I wonder what was in his mind at the time he wrote it. What cosmology was he familiar with? And I wonder if you could go back in time and introduce to him your cosmology based on the Hubble Space, the Hubble Space Telescope and images sent back from Earth or from satellites to planet Earth. I wonder if he would agree with it. I wonder if he'd say, "Oh yeah, that's what I had in mind." I don't think he would. I don't think that's what I had in mind when I said I talked about this firmament. But he says, God put the firmament in the midst of the waters and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. Other translations say simply, he called it sky. And yep, it's up there. I can see it. Step outside, look up, you'll see the blue dome. It doesn't say blue here, but we can look up and see it is blue. The firmament, he called it sky. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Now, some of you may be familiar with the old canopy theory. And I don't know whether there was a canopy of water surrounding the earth or not. Maybe there was. I wasn't living back then. I can't tell you for sure. Nobody kept any photographs. But the old canopy, according to that theory, there was a canopy of water or a thick mist that surrounded the earth. Evidently that's why, according to the theory, or at least some aspects of the theory, that's why the ancients lived for such a long time. Because it protected them, the canopy protected them from UV rays and maybe other harmful things coming through space and entering the Earth's atmosphere. I question that. I can't help but question that because I can't see any difference between people who are protected by either the place where they live or by people who stay in the house most all the time, why they don't live longer than people who go out in the sun. Maybe they do, but I don't see any dramatic difference. That is to say, I don't see, well, those house dwellers, they tend to live through 300-400 years, whereas people who work out in the sun, they only make it at 70, 80, 90 if they're lucky. So I question the old canopy theory. It could be so. I'm not going to say it's not. I don't know. But that was an old theory, and it's been around a long time. Some of you may remember Ernest L. Martin's ring theory. Remember that one? I believe there were rings around the earth like Saturn or one of the other planets. And guess what those rings were composed of? Big old chunks of ice. That's where the water came from in the flood. Wonder, where did all that water come from? Well, God pushed that ice into the atmosphere and it started, the friction melted it, and down came this flood. Of course, I think the canopy theory holds something of the same, that the waters of the flood came from the canopy that surrounded the earth. But those are theories. I don't think you can really prove them. You can show some scriptures that seem to align with that, but I don't think those are things that we can prove. Certainly, it's not something we can dogmatize. That's not point 727 point A in our list of dogmatic statements. We're not going to have that one. We don't know those things. We don't know. There could be some truth to it. But I tell you, if you read it just as it is, if you read it and try to get inside the writer, of the mind of the writer of Genesis, then you get a very different picture. Let's read a little further here in verse 14. He says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament," or the dome, "of the heavens," or the sky, "to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. Now, it does not say lights above the firmament. In the firmament, that would be within the firmament, or the dome, as I understand it. You see, there's water outside the dome, or the firmament, or the expanse. And the sun is not on the other side of the water, according to the way I read this. That is, according to the some of the old theory, the canopy theory. But it seems to say that this is the sun, the moon, and the stars are within the expanse. Okay? If just taking it for like it says, and also comparing it with other cosmologies coming from that time. "And let them be for lights in the firmament." Verse 16, "God made the two great lights. The greater lights rule the day. The lesser lights rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and divide the light from the darkness." Now, if you approach this from the point of view of the writer, looking at cosmologies from his own time that he would have been familiar with, I'm not saying he copied them. I'm saying he had that language in his mind. I mean, he understood the language. He understood the terms. Still, that doesn't rule out divine inspiration. I do believe the text is the message here is inspired. But nevertheless, he still used his own words, his own terms, his own phrases, his own expressions, and that would include expressions that come from other cosmologies. And here's the picture I get. And that is, if I look at this and read it for what it seems to say here, is first of all, there's a dome called the sky. It covers the earth, the disc-like earth. There's nothing here about a planet. Earth means land. It says so in the text. It covers the land. It also tells us how God divided separated the seas, drew all the waters into one place and called them the seas, and the dry land appeared and so on. So you have a canopy covering the earth, a dome, a firmament as it says, and it separated the waters from the waters. In other words, the dome keeps some waters above it, and the waters below it, that's what you call the seas. Okay? Now, in the dome, not above the waters that are above the dome, but in the dome are the sun, the moon, and the stars. Also, that's where the birds fly, within the dome, within the expanse created by this dome. That's the picture that comes to mind when I read this and take it in the most literalistic sense. Is that what you get? And I don't think it actually means that. When, you know, and I'm open to some of the different theories. That's not the point here. But my point is that he is using an ancient cosmology, apparently, or at least he is using the language of an ancient cosmology. In a few moments, we'll talk about some differences. But one of the things I wanted to mention here about that is that whether you're old Earth or young Earth or whatever you are, it doesn't matter. Whatever school of thought you adhere to, there's no question about it, you import modern science into the creation narrative. We all do. And you know, we may have some good points, and some of the things that we think we understand, we may not really understand as well as we think we do. So that's basically the picture I get. Now, once again, I'm not suggesting that the creation narrative is not true. I'm saying it is true, though it is not scientifically precise according to the science as we understand it. In my view, the theological truths that are woven into the narrative are much more important than the questions of when did he make it or how did he do it. That's much more important. And I would like to look at some of those in the remainder of the sermon. First of all, it is important to put the creation narrative in its ancient context. In that world, there were those who worshipped the creature. There were those who regarded the sun, the moon, and the stars as having power over human beings. You've heard of that. We see that in our own world. You know, we see the astrologer, let me read my horoscope for today. That's based on the you know, what's going on up there. Out there. Not really up there, is it? Well, it is. It is. But it is and it's not. I'm all confused now. No, but, you know, we see that going on in our world. Certainly they did it then. They saw the sun, the moon, and the stars as godlike, influencing things going on the earth. And, you know, the point, or one of the major points of the Genesis narrative is this. No, God is sovereign. He appoints those things as He will. That's the point. God is supreme over all these things that are worshipped by the people. God placed the creatures where He wanted the creatures. And guess what? He made a creature bearing His image and His likeness, and He gave him dominion over all these creatures. So don't worship them. God has dominion. And you, the creature He made, man, Adam, you have dominion. You share to a certain degree, you share God's own dominion because you bear His likeness and His image in some sense. So that's one of the major points of the creation narrative here. And anyone living in ancient times, in the time of Moses, anyone familiar with the culture of the Canaanites, would automatically, instantly see that. But they would see something else as well. See something else as well, I think, that we often miss. Because sometimes we read the narrative like it was a scientific document, and we say, yeah, He separated the waters from the waters, and the waters this and that. He drove the waters, and He gathered all the waters in one place. The dry land appeared, and so on. And that's fine as far as it goes, but there's more to the story than that. How did the ancients look upon water? What did they think about the seas? What about the waters above the waters? They had ideas about that. Waters of the deep, the abyss. You know, they believed in waters. When it speaks of the deep here, it's not talking about merely the deep waters of the ocean. It's talking about the deep, the subterranean sea they believed it existed. In other words, the abyss. And I think some theories has it, you can enter into it from the bottom of the ocean. And it's also down underneath the earth. And when it talks about the deep being broken up in Genesis 7, that's what it's talking about. The waters from down beneath are now broken up. Now they're coming up. And I'm not saying that there are no waters down there, or that there weren't any. That's for science. I don't know. But anyway, that's the ideas they had. But what about water? Let's look at some... And what about what they thought about what dwelt in the sea? Well, let's look at some scriptures here. First, let's go to Psalm 74. Psalm 74. And keeping the Genesis 1 creation narrative in mind, we see something else about the creation here in Psalm 74. And let's begin reading in verse 10. It says, O God, how long will the adversary reproach? Will the enemy blaspheme your name forever? Why do you withdraw your hand, even your right hand? Take it out of your bosom and destroy them. You ever pray that kind of prayer about your enemies? In other words, he has his hand here and take it out, you know, draw it out of there and use it on my enemies. For God is my King from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. It says, verse 13, you divided the sea by your strength. What's that referring to? Well, back to the Genesis 1 narrative. Now, the word sea here is an interesting one. It's yam in Hebrew, Y-A-M, yam. Now, the Canaanites, there's a Canaanite hymn that was found that describes yam as the dragon of the sea. It's the name of a powerful beast, one to be feared, the dragon of the sea. And here God says, or the writer says, you, talking about God, divided the yam by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people or the creatures inhabiting the wilderness. Now, Leviathan is an interesting creature, as we shall see later. It's comparable to one of our favorite monsters, Godzilla. All of you are familiar with him, Godzilla. He's something like that, maybe a little bit worse in some cases by the description we see in Job. But continuing on here, I want you to notice how he relates all of this, Leviathan and the sea creatures and so on, to the creation. He continues in verse 15, you broke open the fountain and the flood. You dried up mighty rivers. Yep, he made the dry ground to appear. He called it the earth. The day is yours, the night also. And there was evening and the morning, the first day, evening and morning, the second day, and so on. You have prepared the light and the sun. Read about that back there in the Genesis narrative. You have set all the borders of the earth. You have made summer and winter. Yep, put the lights in the heaven for signs and seasons and so on. Remember this, that the enemy has reproached, O Lord, and that a foolish people has blasphemed your name. So here it's interesting that he employs what we call personification in describing the forces of chaos. You see, when you go back to the Genesis narrative, that's what you see. You see God overcoming the forces of chaos. Right from the very beginning there, after it says God created, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, it says the earth was without form and void. That means the earth was in a condition of chaos. We read about the earth being underwater, whether you think about it as a planet or just the land, which is what the writer had in mind. But it was underwater, and it was under darkness. That's chaos. And what we read here is God driving back the forces of chaos, demonstrating His power and His sovereignty over creation. The way I read it, the Genesis narrative there, verse 2, presupposes that the earth was already there when God began His creative activity on those 6 days. That's the way I understand it. I mean, if somebody disagrees with that, I know we have some people who, or, you know, we have some of our friends who hold a young earth view, and I don't want to fall out with them over that, except to say that, I think they're wrong. They think I'm wrong, but I think that that's a wrong view. I think the earth has been here for millions, maybe billions of years. I think the universe has too. But at the same time, I believe that this was the creation that's described here. Because the creation is not created, that's described in Genesis 1, is not creation ex nihilo. You know what that is? Creation out of nothing. It's not describing that. I do believe in creation ex nihilo, by the way. I do believe that there's some point in the past, I would say billions of years ago, when God caused matter to come into existence. He called it into existence, and there it was. I don't think the 6 days of Genesis are about that. It presupposes that matter is already there. As far as I know, it could have been there billions of years. Again, there's no way of knowing, in my opinion. But this is... someone used another expression to describe this, and I believe they're right. And that is, this is not creation ex nihilo, it's creation ex chaosmos. You can figure out what that means. Chaos. Creation out of chaos. It's creation in the sense of God bringing order out of chaos. God demonstrating His sovereignty over creation, over the matter that did exist at that time, and bringing order out of chaos, establishing the day and the night in the way that man would know it. And He's preparing it, of course, for the pinnacle of His creation, the creature that would bear His image and likeness, man. So that's what the Genesis narrative is really all about, in my view. Now, let's go to some other scriptures here. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 26. Isaiah 26. And let's begin reading there in text here. Isaiah 26 is what I wrote down at least. Let me see. Verse 20. Yeah, it's 26 and 27, really. Verse 20 of 26 says, "Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation is past. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will also disclose her blood and will no more cover her slain." You see what this is talking about. And in verse chapter 27, verse 1, "In that day the Lord with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan." There's that name again. Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, that twisted serpent. "And he will slay the reptile that is in the sea." That's that same language that the Canaanites would have certainly been familiar with. Leviathan, that great twisted serpent. And also the reptile, the dragon in the sea. Let's read also over in, in the book of Job. Turn over to Job 38. And you see something there about the creation. Verse 1, Job 38, verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?'" You know, that's a question I pose to myself when I think about all the creation arguments and all the different views. And I say, well, where was I when he laid the foundation of the earth? Exactly how did he do it? Oh, did he use a big bang way back before the earth was made? I don't know. I wasn't there. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know." A little sarcasm, perhaps. Good sarcasm. "Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea, the yam, with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and the thick darkness its swaddling band? When I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors? When I said, 'This far you may come, but no farther. And here your proud waves must stop.'" So he's talking about creation there. And what he did in creating out of chaos. Creating out of chaos, bringing order out of chaos. Now, with that in mind, let's look at chapter 41. Read several passages here, several verses. Here we see Leviathan comes up again. He says, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook?" Now, the implication is God can. "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" In other words, that would be like saying, and putting it in modern terminology, "Can you go out to the edge of the ocean there, you know, knowing Godzilla is out there, and take your Zebco with you, throw in a line with a little hook on it, and think you can snag him in the jaw and bring him in, put him on the stringer and take him home?" Godzilla we're talking about here. You know who Godzilla is. Goes on to say, will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? This is Leviathan. Will he take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Or you could even say this about a crocodile or something. And this is something here. Leviathan is a whole lot meaner than a crocodile, if you read the whole description of him. Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him, remember the battle, never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me?" See, God is the one who can do all those things. He can control Leviathan. He is sovereign. His power is greater than that of any sea serpent or any creature of the sea. And by the way, I don't think this is talking. I know some people have tried to talk about what kind of beast this is, and they've looked at some of the ancient fossils and so on and saying, well, those are sea serpents. You know, there really were sea serpents in those days, and men really saw them. And some of those stories from the ancient mariners about sea serpents out at sea are based on truth. Well, they may be based on truth, but I don't think any of them actually saw this creature here, not Leviathan. This is a mythological beast, in my opinion, a mythological beast. I won't read the whole thing here, but it goes on to talk about how he blows out fire and all that, just like Godzilla, and all the things he does. This is a mythological beast, but it is a personification of the forces of chaos. And the point is, God is sovereign over creation. God has power over the forces of chaos. But again, I think this is a simple personification. Also back in Psalm 74, I think that is a personification of the forces of chaos. Talking about the same thing you read about in Genesis when you read about the waters and understanding from the ancient point of view, the waters were the home of Leviathan and other serpents, and the waters themselves were to be, you know, were something that caused a lot of terror in the hearts of men because they knew that the waters could rage, as it were. And they were associated with these forces of chaos. And when we read in Genesis about God dividing the waters, when we see how he caused the waters to go into one place and called them the seas and so on, it's telling the reader from that period that God has power over the forces of chaos. Now then, with all of that in mind, I'd like to show you that a reason for believing the forces of chaos are more than mere personifications. Now, I don't believe there's a real beast called Leviathan that breathes fire and all that. But I do believe these forces of chaos that are personified in in Psalm 74 and also in Job 41 and mentioned in Isaiah 26, they do represent, these personifications do represent a real world, real beings who actually exist, are personal, and are the real agents of chaos. Go with me to Revelation 12, and let's see something that sounds very familiar to Leviathan. Revelation chapter 12. Here is a vision. It says, now, verse 1, now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor and pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns. Sometimes Leviathan is described as multi-headed, and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the earth. Now this, traditionally we understand this to mean of being a reference to a third of the angels falling with Lucifer, and I have absolutely no problem with that understanding. None at all. I'm not suggesting something else. I do believe when John describes this, he's simply describing the way he saw it. And I do believe what it suggests is he looks and he sees this great serpent. It's a terrifying beast. And when he sees its tail sweep across the sky, it knocks down a third of the stars. Now that's powerful. I think that's his point here. This is one powerful beast. And he's standing there ready to devour the child, and we understand this is Christ, as soon as he is born. He goes on to talk about that. Let's drop down to verse 5. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God in his throne, referring to Christ, of course. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that she should feed her, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out. Now here we see a definition of the dragon. The text itself identifies who the dragon is. This is not merely a personification of the forces of chaos. This is the person who is responsible for so much of the chaos in the world. He says, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan who deceives the whole world. So this, again, this is not a mere personification of the forces of chaos. That is the author of chaos, the devil, a very real and very personal devil. Then I heard a voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. Drop on down to verse 13. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman. Kind of sounds familiar there, doesn't it? A little, you know, use of water here in this description. Also, as you go on down to chapter 13, I'm not going to read through that, but you see another beast that looks very similar to the dragon, having seven heads and ten horns. And he comes up out of the ocean, interestingly enough. Out of the ocean. And elsewhere in Revelation, we read about the beast that ascends from the bottomless pit. Sounds an awful lot like the deep or the abyss. He comes up through the abyss. That's the habitation of evil. And through the ocean, he comes up out of the ocean to what? Introduce chaos on the earth. So here we have the forces of chaos. And even though there's a lot of symbolic language here, it is very clear that there is the chief agent of chaos. It is none other than Satan the devil. We know he has demons. This and many other scriptures tell us. So when we go back to the creation narrative, put it in context of the ancient world, understand it also in light of Psalm 74 and Isaiah 26 and Job 41, and also what the New Testament reveals, I think it is safe to say that the devil was involved in the original condition of chaos. It doesn't say so in the Genesis narrative. But I say that, you know, someone recently said that this idea that the devil was the cause of the, you know, the condition of chaos. The idea was totally made up. Well, not really. Not really. There's something behind it, as you can see, I hope. There's something there. So when you put other scriptures together and you see how chaos comes about and understand that the point of the Genesis narrative, or one of the major points, is that God is sovereign over creation and God brings order out of chaos, regardless how powerful the forces of chaos may be. He's more powerful. That's the point. That's a major point. So when we look at the world today, we see quite a bit of chaos as well. So the devil, we understand, is still running loose. There are real demons in the world. There is a spirit world. Perhaps in our modern age, our enlightenment, we would like to think that those are just personifications of evil. But all too often they've proven themselves to be very real personalities, very real beings. And we're told that the devil is the god of this world. To me, that sounds like an awfully powerful position. He's the god of this world. His angels, his agents are working in the world. The devil himself is the prince of the power of the air, who is now working in the sons of disobedience. That's a lot of stuff you read in the New Testament about the power of this agent, this leading chief agent of chaos. We see in the world today floods and tsunamis and volcanic activity. I don't know how much of that can be attributed to the devil, if any of it. I seem to get from the scriptures that he has power to interfere with weather patterns and so on. I don't know how much of that is attributed to him. I don't think the oil spill is the result of the devil's work, but who knows? At the end of the day, we might find out he was involved in a lot more things than we have realized. And, of course, conditions could be much, much worse than they are today. And we all recognize the potential for things to get a lot worse is clearly there. And Scripture is clear. The very real forces of chaos are at work in the world and will one day expand their kingdom just before the end. That's the description of the devil being cast down and his angels with him. The forces of chaos will expand their kingdom in the world. But there's good news on the other side of that. The good news is the same good news you see in the creation narrative. God is sovereign God is more powerful than the forces of chaos. He exercises dominion over the forces of chaos. Once again, he will defeat Leviathan and the monstrous serpents of the sea. And this time, he will create a new heaven and a new earth. And may God speed that day.